This recording is part of the University of Adelaide Archives program of oral history, in which members of staff and former members of staff of the university are interviewed so that a record exists, in their own words, of their own achievements and activities at the university, and also to capture their recollections and opinions about the university more generally. This interview is with John Keeler, formerly an associate professor in the law school at the University of Adelaide. John was born close to Windsor in England. He was educated in Windsor and then at Jesus College at the University of Oxford, where he graduated with a BA in Jurisprudence in 1963 and a Bachelor in Civil Law in 1964. From Oxford, John moved directly to the law school at the University of Adelaide, where he has spent his entire career, formally retiring in 2002, but where he remains active as an adjunct associate professor. During his time at Adelaide, John has served on the University Council in the 1980s and 1990s, and on many other committees, both within the law school and more widely. John was long active in staff association affairs and was a habitué of the University Staff Club, where he was a founder and long-serving member of the famous Table 4. So, John, it's been a long career at the university, but can we start with you describing something of your origins, your early life, and what brought you to Adelaide?
My parents were evacuated from Romford in Essex to Windsor when the bombing started in the Second World War. And the evacuation was because my mother was pregnant with me. So I was born just outside Windsor and educated in Windsor, initially at the local Catholic primary school, where my grandmother, who had been one of the original suffragettes and early people to early women to qualify as a primary school teacher, was the reception class teacher. From there, I took the 11 plus, went to the local Windsor Grammar School, and from there, I went to Oxford. I got to Oxford on a scholarship. The person who interviewed me was the Lord Don of Jesus College, Arthur Rogerson. Fortunately, he and I had some kind of mental compatibility, which meant initially that I got the scholarship and I got to Oxford. Secondly, that he took an interest in me. When I went up for the scholarship and he interviewed me, he asked me the standard question: what did I think I would like to do after I'd finished the degree? State schools in England didn't prepare one for interviews or such questions. And my response was that on the whole, I thought I would like to become an Oxford Don and teach at Oxford. But before I did that, I'd like to teach at a university in Canada or Australia for 3 or 4 years. Anyway, after 3 years, I did the BA in Jurisprudence and didn't do as well as Arthur had expected or hoped, because by then he had accepted the position of Professor, Bonython Professor of Laws at the University of Adelaide. And his idea had been that I should succeed him at Oxford. But since I hadn't done well enough, one of my friends succeeded him, which was interesting because my first teaching experience was actually taking classes with him for the final year in the year behind me as part of their revision for their exams and my revision stroke work for the BCL. But after having come here and having worked out that I wasn't going to succeed him, looked at me and said, well, how about Adelaide then? That was in line with what you suggested. And so I applied for a lectureship at the University of Adelaide. I'm not sure that Arthur wrote one of the official references, but certainly his friends in Oxford wrote the official references. And perhaps with an element of an Oxford education and an element of patronage, who knows? I got a lectureship here and arrived in August 1964.
Directly to the position at the University of Adelaide?
Yep. The BCL exam was in June. The results came out at the end of June, beginning of July. And again, with a good deal of fortune, I did well enough in that to justify the appointment by the time I got here.
Very good.
The ship actually sailed, the Iberia sailed on July the 21st, which was no more than 6 weeks after the exams.
My word. Okay, so straight from the University of Oxford to the University of Adelaide, that must have been quite a contrast in experience, in academically, the urban experience and everything.
I find in some ways that hard to remember, because Oxford is obviously a residential university, and I'd been there for 4 years, 2 years living in college, 2 years in Dimps. And yes, at a residential university, one gets accustomed to a city which was, what, 200,000 or 300,000, but a university city. On the other hand, one's home was Windsor, which was 20,000 or 30,000, and my parents had come from London. So I suppose my urban experience was, yes, Oxford, Windsor, London. And Adelaide has wider streets and a more open appearance than any of those three.
Indeed.
It doesn't have what I suppose is essentially an 18th, 19th century castle, even if it goes back to the 11th century in the centre. And it doesn't have colleges that go back to the 14th and 15th century all around. So yes, it's different. Also, Oxford's a collegiate system. Yes, there's a university. Yes, I knew that every college had 2-3 law dons, so I knew that there were 30 people, 40 people teaching law there. And yes, I had encountered several of them. But I never encountered anything that resembled a department of law or a faculty of law, because on the whole, one doesn't. One may come across 2 or 3 people whom one identifies as being from different colleges taking a graduate seminar, and I certainly encountered that. But it was never a question, I suppose, of joining a group of people who were responsible for a curriculum, a syllabus, overall. So that was different. It was also really a relatively small experience, not by comparison with Oxford, by what it's become. When I arrived, I was the 10th member of the staff of the law school. One of them being, only one of them being younger than me and described as a tutor rather than a lecturer at the time. The law school had, earlier in the year, moved into new quarters, which at the time were, I think I'd call it, the first floor of the Napier building. People who know the Napier building will recognise it as the one with the orange band round it from the outside. The law school had moved there as its final home for for an institution that was never going to have more than 250 students. It had more than 250 students at the time I arrived. We lasted in those quarters until January 1967, at which point we had 375 students, so we were already 50% bigger. And we moved to a building which was supposed to take 500 or 600. It now has two extra floors, most of which the law school is only just beginning to get hold of, but there are 1,500 students enrolled in law degrees at any one time now.
My word. And so Arthur Rogerson was the professor, or were there more professors back in 1964?
In 1964, there were two professors. Dan O'Connell had a personal chair. Arthur came as Bonython professor and the person who was supposed to manage the law school. This was largely not because I think Dan wanted to be a research professor, but because Vic Edgelow, the registrar, hadn't liked the way Dan had run the law school when he was acting head of the law school in the previous years. Yeah. In Vic Edgelow's estimation, I think, too many of the resources that had been granted to the law school had gone into Dan's speciality of international law.
Right. And
I think there was a feeling that what they wanted was somebody who would, after all, be the professor and manager for a law school which at the time was the only law school in South Australia, and where a degree in law was a prerequisite to going on to articles and being able to practice. Mm. And Arthur, although he had been a full-time academic at Jesus College for some time, had been a practicing member of the Northern Circuit, and his visits to Adelaide. His name had been suggested to the faculty by a professor of the University of Oxford, Rupert Cross, who had come here for a few months on study leave and really liked Adelaide.
Rupert Cross from Oxford, or
from Magdalen College, Oxford.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he's a great man in the history of, I suppose, English law. Rupert was blinded at the age of two, and his specialities were evidence and criminal law. He gave some of the first lectures I ever attended at the University of Oxford, some of the few lectures I ever attended at the University of Oxford. And he'd been the person presiding over the seminars in evidence in the BCL postgraduate course I did. But he'd liked Adelaide. He'd, I think, been put up at St Mark's and was a bit of a bon viveur in various ways. At least he appreciated the good things of life. And the things that he particularly appreciated by name were the Barossa Valley, the McLaren Vale and Cooper's Brewery.
Right, okay. Which no doubt enlivened his lectures.
Well, they enlivened mine. I'm not sure that they enlivened his. I mean, I have one very early student memory of Rupert. Arthur had arranged a moot between ourselves and students at another college. I don't remember. The moot was held in the senior common room of Jesus College. It was therefore in an elegant 17th century panelled room, round a polished, elegant table, on one side of which was myself and two of my colleagues from Jesus College, and on the other, the opposition. Rupert was the judge, and he was sitting at the head of the table. One of the things I had to argue was that drunkenness should not be treated as a defence, or allowable as a defence in murder cases. And, you know, no. An over-enthusiastic way, I'd gone back, discovered various quotations from Sir Matthew Hale, criminal, written about criminal law, 17th century, the course of which he made various comments about wine and alcohol as noxious substances and toxins, and I'd taken the line that the voluntary ingestion of toxins and noxious substances shouldn't be allowable as a defence, all of which was a little more difficult because Rupert was smiling beatifically and, of course, being blind, you couldn't actually read anything into him as he caressed a large balloon of brandy.
Wonderful. Well, 1964... Sorry, in 1964 in Adelaide, that was Henry Baston, Vice-Chancellor.
Yes, but I didn't know very much about Vice-Chancellors in those days.
But the university was very small at that stage. Well,
From memory, it was probably about 5,000 against the 25,000.
Really?
Now, it might have been smaller. A friend of mine, Michael Harris, who became a colleague very soon, a tutor in 65 and by 66, 67, a lecturer. Michael had graduated in 1963. So this is the year of their 50th anniversary. I don't think he'll be able to come, but he told me that his cohort was about 25.
Right.
When I arrived, it was probably, there were probably 45 or 50 being admitted each year, but not that many graduating.
Mm.
In 1967, I think, 66 or 67, we were told that the law school had to have a quota. The quota was set at 100 and we didn't fill it. The first time the quota bit was probably a year or two after that, 68. Perhaps 67 or 68, and it bit to the extent of one person who got in the next year. But by the 1970s, the quota was 140, and we were excluding 50 or 60 applicants a year.
Yeah.
And so it's gone on. I think we now let in something over 300 a year.
Mm.
But then there are two other law schools.
And who defined who established the quota system? Was that a university?
Yes.
Yeah.
The university insisted we had.
Mm.
We didn't propose it.
And does the university still have discretion in how many students are admitted to particular disciplines?
Trying, even in my own mind, to work out the history of that is really very complicated. The answer is for many years, the Commonwealth essentially set quotas for the university, for the university sector. It became an interesting proposition because there was an overall quota, but then there were quotas within different fields. So that, for instance, the Commonwealth still sets a very clear quota for medical students, perhaps dental students.
Mm.
Since funding was attached to numbers, quotas in areas like medicine and eventually law kept people out, but in other areas it was necessary to fill the quota in order to get the anticipated funding. I don't know when it happened, but by the 1980s, the 1990s, if the university was going to fall short in some areas, it had a certain discretion that it could go above quota in others. And so, if it was falling short in arts or science, it tended to increase the numbers that it actually admitted in law or commerce or disciplines where there was A, they were cheap to teach, and B, they were in high demand. And so there were occasions where there was an insane routine whereby we'd spend some months in one year establishing what the quota in law should be, and the number was approved by the university system in November or December. And then come enrolment, we were short in other fields and couldn't backfill in those fields. And so the number that had been so painfully arrived at and agreed was on, by then, the say-so of a deputy vice-chancellor, increased so that the university overall could match the number of places it was supposed to have before it lost funding. I don't know whether we actually have an official quota anymore, but I do know that we tend to let in something over 300. There was one horrid year, a couple of horrid years, where whatever number we thought we were going to have, certainly in one of the last years I was teaching, the class was 450 as a first year class, and I think a year or two later it may have been even bigger than that.
I have arrived at the university in 1975, which was in the middle of the, well, or towards the end of the Whitlam years, when there was enormous expansion of universities. Was that a period of great increase in numbers in law?
No, it wasn't, because in 1970 the quota for law had been fixed at 140. We were getting many more applications than that,
right,
but we were kept at 140. It had all sorts of interesting spin-offs. For a while it was thought that Flinders would have a law school, and the Law Society for 3 or 4 years established a transition course for people who couldn't get into law at Adelaide, but who were going to finish at the Flinders Law School when the Flinders Law School opened. But the Flinders Law School didn't, in fact, open in the 1970s. It didn't open until 1991.
Right.
The Law Society couldn't maintain that course. Those people who did the course, they awarded a certificate to and allowed to practice. But there were only 3 or 4 years of entrance into that particular course. And after that, students who couldn't get into Adelaide went often to Tasmania, and then when the university system expanded and more law schools opened, by the late 80s, they were going to Tasmania and Bond. Eventually Darwin got a law school. And so Adelaide students were going interstate. Mainly if they could get into Adelaide, they stayed in Adelaide rather than go to the ANU or Sydney. But there were law schools that it was easier to get into, or that you could pay to get into.
Right.
And they would go to those. But the law school itself had a different sort of problem, really. The profession wanted it to expand. It wanted more students in. The university was holding the quota. The profession, as I say, started its own course in the expectation of Flinders opening. Then children of Adelaide practitioners found themselves going to Tasmania and Darwin or Bond. And so the profession had put a lot of pressure for the law school to expand its quota. In fact, what the law school did for a little while in the 1980s was reduce it. It wasn't getting resources from the university, and it reduced the quota to 125 with a plan to increase it later on. This, of course, put the profession markedly against us, and they backed the opening of a Flinders Law School by, I suppose it was 1990. The politics have become really, really very difficult. Politics were essentially that the Dawkins Revolution was overtaking the universities, and the universities were being made to change through, in various ways, through Commonwealth government diktat. But by 1990, the diktat had more or less been achieved, and the Commonwealth government, still a Labour government, wanted to demonstrate that it was not running the universities in every way. So while there was pressure from lots of universities to expand, to have law schools or expand into different disciplines, the Commonwealth delegated the decisions, more or less, to state governments. Flinders was much more on, despite the best efforts of Frank O'Neill, Flinders was much more on side with the state government than the University of Adelaide. The University of Adelaide was offering an expansion in the quota of an existing law school from 125 to about 200. Flinders was offering a new law school.
Mm-hmm.
And the state government opted to back Flinders.
Mm.
So while there was a huge expansion of the Adelaide Law School, it was an expansion in the 1990s for other reasons, which became a huge expansion in the late 1990s with the what I describe as perverse operation of quota systems.
Mm.
Flinders opened in 1991.
And since then we've seen law at the University of South Australia.
Yes. That's, what, 5 years old now.
Mm. 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 So a great many lawyers being produced.
Yes, despite the pressure from the profession in the 70s and early 80s. I mean, I still remember one ludicrous bit of correspondence. You say you arrived in 1975. Mm. That was the first year I was dean of the law school here. My predecessor had been Ivan Shearer. Ivan had a letter from the president of the Law Society explaining that there was a great shortage of lawyers in the profession. The university and the law school needed to expand their quota, and indeed they needed to double their quota. Nothing happened, of course.
Mm.
We didn't double our quota. My successor, Brent Fissey, took over as dean in 1977. And within a few months, he had a letter from the same person, who was by now no longer president of the Law Society, but chair of the Council of the Professions for South Australia, explaining that there was a massive surplus of lawyers in South Australia, and it was necessary to halve the quota, mm. to halve that self-same quota which he'd insisted be doubled.
Yes.
4 years before. Had we done it, an extra cohort would have been going through, and he would have demanded that we reduce the quota by three quarters.
Yes. Yeah.
But when we did, one of the things we actually had in mind was not so much the pressure from the profession, which in my estimation came from two sources. One was a general democratic notion that people who wanted to do law should be able to do law. But there was also an element that relatives of practitioners weren't able to get into Adelaide and so had to go elsewhere. But despite that, one of the things that we tried to consult about was indeed roughly how many graduates we thought that the profession could absorb. And it actually was around 140 to 150 a year. So when Flinders opened and we went up to 180 and the number of entrance to law courses within a couple of years was up at 280 to 300, let alone what was happening 10 years later when we were taking 400, Flinders was taking 120 and so on, was that there's an evident disconnect, I think, between the number of people who, number of students who come in to read law in Adelaide and the capacity of South Australia, the need of South Australia for lawyers, which is why it became very easy for the Adelaide Law School in particular to start arguing from the late, well, mid-1990s on, but certainly the late 1990s, and we've been arguing it, I think, for nearly 20 years now, that we have no option but to be a national law school. I can't remember, I was head of department and acting dean 1993-1994. And one of those years, I think, all bar one of our honour students went interstate for their careers.
But what do you mean by a national law school?
Oh, it's no use us saying that we are training people for what South Australia wants.
Oh, I see.
But if there's a demand which says that nationally we need, and this is, of course, mainly Sydney, Queensland, now it may be West Australia, the demand is for commercial lawyers or environmental lawyers, we actually have to aim very clearly for national standards, cross international standards, because there's no point in aiming for local standards.
But aren't interstate universities producing an enormous number of lawyers as well?
One of the remarkable paradoxes to me, but still, of the early years of the Howard government, now admittedly by then it was building on the Dawkins Revolution and so on, was that when I came here, there were a limited number of universities and 8 law schools. By 2000, there were 37 law schools in Australia. If you're going to say you're national, you are going to have to be competitive. You're going to have to stay in most first 7 or 8 because your graduates are going to have to be preferable to those of 30 other universities. So I guess that's what I think when I say we have no option but to aim at being a high level, national law school.
And has Adelaide achieved that?
We're still in the top 8 or 9 of Australian law schools on any of the ranking systems that are used. Whether or not that's good enough is doubtful, and I'm entirely certain that our present dean would think it's inadequate. At various stages, I think we've been better than that, and I'm sure that at various stages we've been seen as being worse than that. So I think that for the moment, the Adelaide Law School is in a reasonable position and one from which it can improve and will be aimed to improve.
Now, you mentioned over the years how the profession has been anxious to see number of trainee lawyers increase and also how it's felt too many lawyers are being produced. Now, with 3 law schools in South Australia, does the profession have a view
You know, I haven't asked it.
Right.
I know that the things that have worried the profession in recent years are not so much the number of graduates, but the fact that such a high proportion of the best ones either choose to move into state immediately and avoid some of the difficulties of finding positions in Adelaide, but also that some of those that do stay find themselves limited by what the Adelaide profession offers and move into state within 3 or 4 years. I think they're more worried about their capacity to retain our best students and our best graduates now than they are about the number. I think they've got to the stage of thinking, well, law graduates do move into state. Law graduates do actually embark on careers other than law. Lots of law graduates change careers from law after 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
And I think that probably across the nation and now in Adelaide, there's a little bit more of a shrug of the shoulders and saying the law degree isn't just for lawyers.
Mm.
And if people don't make it or don't want to make it in law, then they can do other things. But it is a shame that we can't keep the best of those who do want to to maintain a career in law.
I'll move us back to the university in just a minute, but it occurs to me that the nature of professions more widely has changed, so that in many instances some knowledge of the law is now very useful, and so this presents an opening for lawyers to move into other areas very easily and bring those skills with them.
That was our theory. When we planned to move from 125 to 180 at the end of the 1980s, or in the 1980s, and eventually we did in the 1990s, it was done at the same time as we introduced, under the deanship of Jim Hambrook, who was very dedicated to it, a system whereby we moved from being one of, by then, I think a minority of the group of 8 universities which focused on a straight 4-year law degree, and moved to a system of encouraging people to do double degrees.
Mm.
I mean, in some ways, I mean, effectively, we did make it compulsory.
Mm.
We, but partly it was by changing the entry system, but the thing that actually clinched it was that nobody could qualify for an LLB degree unless they had qualified or obtained a degree in another field.
Mm.
On the whole, we thought that that would probably encourage double degrees in arts and international studies, though Jim went to enormous lengths to ensure that the double degree was as widely available as possible. And in the end, I think the only double degrees which weren't possible were law medicine and law dentistry.
Right.
I mean, medicine did have a degree for people who weren't going to be doctors called Bachelor of Medical Science, and that was a double degree. A double degree in law and engineering was much more difficult. In pretty well all the other programs, arrangements were done so that it was possible to do the double degree, the 2 degrees in 5 years. That wasn't possible with engineering.
Mm.
But it didn't mean we didn't have people who'd done a double degree in law and engineering. So, yes, the idea was that law could lawyers would benefit because that they would have specialities open to them where they could make use of their expertise in science or engineering so that they would be able to get into patent law or things like that much more easily. But at the same time, I mean, engineering, for instance, has always been very focused on people being project managers. And so there are double degrees with engineering and entrepreneurship and finance and so on. What tended to happen, in fact, was that the first double degrees that were most popular were arts, and then it became law commerce because of the overlap between accountancy and law is very strong. It wasn't entirely what we wanted.
And very lucrative.
During the period before the global financial crisis, it was an area to be in. Since then, I gather it's still okay if you want to make insolvency your speciality.
Moving with the times.
This
move to double degrees, did it change the sort of the quality of the students as they evolved through the course?
No, it didn't at all. Mainly because pressure on entry was so competitive. Initially, when we introduced it, early 1990s perhaps, we were very purist about it, and we didn't accept anybody into law on the basis of their TER or their matric scores. We worked on the basis that the best predictor of university performance was university performance. And so our criterion for entry was how well you'd done in the first year of the course that you'd been doing before. And I don't know. The net result was that in a bad year, our criterion for the bottom entry was people who got credits in half the subjects they'd done. Nearly all the people who got into law had actually done better than that, but that was the bottom. We weren't allowed to keep that for very long after 1991, because some schools and some applicants didn't like the thought that they wouldn't do well enough in first year to get into law when they could get straight into law at Flinders,
right,
on the basis of their TER. And so by the mid-late 1990s, we had a dual system whereby the very top people, those with 98 and above, could be given automatic entry to law. And the rest of it was still done on the basis of how well they'd done in first year. But as I say, the competition was so high that there was no loss of quality.
But by being required to study another discipline for a year before entry into law, this would have meant that most law students would be that little bit more mature. Was there a perceptible difference in the students' life, the student calibre?
We thought it was nice. I mean, it was good for us. And there were various parts of, especially the arts faculty, that liked it too. Because we made students do the previous degree, they had 3 years with students who might never have gone into arts at all. And they had 3 years to persuade them that they would like to do honours in arts and convert them. So the double degree was, in fact, a bit, and I think it still is really rather popular with the arts faculty in particular. The compulsory double degree was terminated, as they say, soon after 2001. But there was a review of the law school in 2001, and again, some influential members of the profession put in submissions to the effect that they didn't see why the university should insist that people have two degrees when the profession didn't, and that it was non-democratic. And so we now have the single degree available again. I don't know that many people do it because, again, if you're going into a workforce where you need to be competitive, and you need to be competitive with people who across Australia have done two degrees, because there is the Melbourne model, everybody from Melbourne will have another degree. But apart from that, even in the 1990s, more than 80% of graduates in law from Sydney, New South Wales, Melbourne and Monash had got double degrees. So that people with an Adelaide single degree going into a national competition were putting themselves at a considerable disadvantage. It's competitive pressures that, in the end, shape what people do. And so, while the double degree isn't compulsory anymore, it's only a minority of people.
It remains the norm.
It remains the norm.
Can we move, John, to... You've had a long association with activities more widely in the university. Can we just talk about some of those?
And how they started? Well, they started right back in 1964 to 1966. Arthur Rogerson had come from a collegiate background. Yes, he had a staff of 10, but it was an interesting staff. Arthur was not yet 40, and he and Dan were clearly the oldest members of the staff. Horst Looker was probably 32. Alex Castles was just coming up to 30. Colin Howard, who left at the end of the year for a chair at Melbourne, was in his early to mid-30s. He was replaced by people in their early 30s. And the rest of us were in our 20s. The youngest was Brent Fissey at 22. Mike Trebilco and I were 23. David Kelly and Ivan Shearer were perhaps 25 or 26. It wasn't clear, I think, in Arthur's mind whether being collegiate in a group such as that was the same as being collegiate in a senior common room in Oxford, or whether it was as much a mentoring experience as anything else. And he treated it that way. But as part of the mentoring, but as part of acquiring a collegiate experience himself, he was he made extensive use of the university staff club, and he was a member of Table 4, which had been, I think, founded by Frank D.L. and from psychology, with a lot of psychologists like Tony Minefield, and Carmel Young from classics, which meant that John Travaskis, who was the professor, joined it from time to time. But there are a lot of historians and so on. And it became a table where the older collegiate thing was just about possible, but it was still a very young table. People were still lecturers, senior lecturers in their 30s, and it was a very expanding university. So that was intellectually enormously stimulating. I mean, the thing that drove Frank and Carmel was not research in their specific fields, which, you know, they accepted was part of their life, but it was not part of their driving characteristics. But they were enormously intellectually curious over a very wide field, and so it became that it was easy for extroverts, as they were, with that kind of intellectual curiosity, to attract people of all kinds to that table. Now, once you attract people of all kinds, Yes, you will get the researchers, but then other things will happen. Table 4 provided a lot of committee members of the staff club, for instance. Maybe they weren't presidents to start with, but they were members of the committee. Arthur, as part of his collegiate style, was willing to accept the notion that professors should take responsible positions in the staff association. And he became, in 1966, he became president, and he persuaded David Kelly and myself onto the committee, and we got various things to do. Over time, more members of Table 4 joined the staff association, the staff club. And as one acquired, the thing about both the club and the association was that one became interested in other parts of the university and the university, as well as one's own neck of the woods. And of course, because it attracted such a wide range of people, and some of them were professors, I mean, Arthur, Jack Smart from philosophy would come over, John Trebaskis. It had people who were running departments, not always happily and not always committedly. Table 4 not merely produced, therefore, members of the staff club committee, the staff association committee, it began to develop people who eventually became, well, Table 4 was one of the places where the move towards elected heads of department took off. Mm. In fact, it formally took off with a request signed by 20 members of the staff association for a special general meeting to discuss it.
And special general meeting
of the staff association, yep, to discuss the topic. And more than half the signatures came from Table 4.
Right.
There were also the kind of people that once the departmental government or the elected head of school and a kind of democratisation of university committees took place, as it did with Jeff Badger as Vice-Chancellor. Table 4 tended to provide people who became heads of school, and as I say, by 1975, when you arrived, I was president of the Staff Association, mm-hmm, and Dean of Law. The Deans of Arts were both active members of the Staff Association, and as deans, we were all members of then the Education Committee and the Academic Board.
Mm.
Regardless of that, Jeff Badger had established a committee system where there was something called the Planning Committee, not one of the university's most successful experiments, but it was supposed to be a committee that looked to the long-term future of the university, but also got the job of writing the university's submissions to the Australian University Commission for Resources. So it really had to be a university-wide thing. And Lee Kirsten, who was another Table 4 habitué, and I, as well as others from different parts of the university. Max Ball, whom I still, from engineering, still greet in this club in a friendly way, were members of that initial, yeah, planning committee.
Yeah.
So Table 4 sort of expanded into the university life in lots,
mm,
of ways.
Mm. And to some degree then served as a catalyst for the move from professorial government of the departments to departmental government, elected government.
It was. It certainly had a substantive role. It didn't do it on its own. Obviously, it didn't do it on its own. It couldn't have done it on its own. But because it was the kind of place that did attract other people, even those who weren't members of it, there were those who would come once a week or once a fortnight and talk things over. The Staff Association's first effort, it was a bit of a damn squib. I mean, that first special general meeting set up a committee to report back as to whether or not it was a good getting rid of the professorial head, one professor as head of department, was a good idea. It was chaired by a psychologist called Don McNichol, who became a vice chancellor of two universities, Sydney and Tasmania, I think, later in his career, and it recommended against it and brought back its report to another general meeting of the Staff Association, which took place more than a year later.
So the Staff Association committee recommended against...
No, the special committee...
Oh, I beg your pardon.
..that had been set up recommended against it.
And but who had set it up?
Oh, the general meeting.
Right, of the Staff
Association. The special general meeting.
Had
voted that there should be a committee to look into it. The Staff Association committee had then appointed members. They reported back more than a year later, one or two page report recommending against it. And another general meeting rejected that report and set up another committee, which is, again, one of the two committees. I don't remember it quite as well as the other one that was awkward in my life, but still, I remember it because I chaired it. It had Tony Winefield, Jeff Scott, Don Stranks, Alex Castles, and I think from time to time Harry Medlin on it. I wrote their report after lots of consultations with people whose brains we were tapping, though we never expected them to support the proposal. And that committee came back with a recommendation in favour of a system of elected heads of department. There was again a general meeting by then, 72, I suppose, which took 8 hours. It was 2 4-hour meeting, which endorsed it. And thereafter, staff club committees and subcommittees of staff club committees actually produced the proposal.
Staff club, staff association. Staff
association, the staff association committees produced the proposals, which eventually Alex Castles, Harry Medlin and Don Stranks put up to the education committee in late 73 or 74, and had the whole thing discussed seriously and eventually adopted in principle.
Right. And was the great resistance within the university to the move to departmental government, elected government?
There were those who didn't think it could work.
Mainly from the professoriate?
Yeah, the professoriate of the Faculty of Medicine was reluctant. We were never clear, and I still don't know in the end. The mighty people in the university in those days included Jeff Badger, who was vice-chancellor. He was fairly open-minded, I think. There was the professor of physical and inorganic chemistry, who was Dodge Jordan. We never quite knew which way Dodge would go. We didn't know which way John Carver, the elder, that is the father of the present, and the then professor of physics, would go. He was very constructive. But at all events, with this, I think with more scepticism than opposition, it got through.
Mm. Mm. And reflecting on that, well, it was something which presumably was happening in universities generally.
We were pioneers.
Really?
I mean, the movement was... there was a general movement and various relaxations took place. But by... Adelaide just kept taking it further.
Right.
And it kept taking it further in ways which by then were entirely outside the original impetus from the staff association. I mean, at one level, Harry Medlin was involved, of course, as Harry was in everything. But we had a number, and I guess this is where official histories are much better than me. We had various reviews of the system of university governance. And one of them was done where the consultants, as it were Neil Blewett and David Corbett, who were professors of politics at Flinders at the time. Neil had been here. I should have known Neil better. He'd done his postgraduate work at Jesus College, which I... and he actually saved the whole elect head of departments movement at the very first special general meeting. Even supporters who were professors were so sceptical, they thought it wasn't worth going on with. And eventually... the speech at that meeting, which encouraged people to set up the committee, even the one that was negative and whose report was rejected. But the person who swayed the meeting into keeping the thing alive was Neil.
Right, okay.
Anyway, he and David Corbett produced the report on university governance, which essentially wasn't looking at all at departments. It was willing to accept that. But it essentially was the report which basically said that the main committee of the university should be the education committee, which should have an executive committee.
Mm-hmm.
And that the executive committee should be the body that produced AUC submissions and things like that, but should also essentially allocate the various pools of resources that the Commonwealth gave us, so that there was an executive member for, I suppose, essentially staffing. Yeah, executive member for staffing, executive member for research, executive member for buildings, and so on. And the theory of that, and the practice of it, was that the education committee was responsible not just for policy, but for endorsing various kinds of allocation of funding, and that it was responsible by receiving reports and recommendations from its executive committee. You started off with the education committee, which by now had elected heads of department and elected deans on it. And it was, in turn, electing not merely the chair of the education committee, but its executive committee, and therefore the people who were eventually going to be chairing the committees which did talk about and deal in staffing, allocations of staffing and resources and so on. Now, Adelaide was the only university that ever adopted that model.
Right.
Which was ultimately deemed unworkable by a number of experts And Peter Carmel, for instance, advised at least one or two persons who'd applied for vice-chancellorships at Adelaide to withdraw their applications on the ground that it was an unworkable model.
Right.
But eventually it collapsed under just the weight of centralisation from the federal government.
Mm, mm, mm. And during the years while that system was operational, was it successful in your opinion?
Hard to say. It worked for me. Steve Lincoln was executive member for research for some time before I joined. I mean, I was the last executive member for staffing. In the end, it broke down for two reasons. One, as I say, was the federal government's adherence to principles of accountability meant that it wanted all sorts of information much more quickly than we could get it. Secondly, while it was called an executive committee, it had no executive authority, actually.
Mm.
The executive was still the vice-chancellor and the registrar. So although we set policy and we set various things, we couldn't always, as it were, execute them.
Mm.
And we only dealt with part of the funds, the university's funding. There was the finance committee started off with a division of what was to go to academic and library purposes and what was to go to other purposes. And as a financial crisis ensued, and once you get into a financial crisis with that system, you need finance to have a stronger influence on the other side of things. So I suppose for 10 years it was an interesting experiment, and the university didn't go backwards during those 10 years, as far as I could tell.
Mm.
It, in the words of Gavin Brown, who was the vice-chancellor who had to kill it off, he inherited a university that was punching above its weight.
Right. Which is a phrase one hears quite often in South Australia, actually.
Yes, but it was still an interesting phrase from somebody who'd had his career at the University of New South Wales before he went to the University of Sydney.
Mm.
So, I don't think it was a disaster.
Right.
And it was an interesting experiment.
So, you were executive member for staffing, but equally you had you played a strong role in the staff association. Did those two roles coexist successfully?
It was very easy because they were sequential. They weren't concurrent.
Even so.
Even so. Some of the things that I found hardest because of that background were that I inherited the job of chairing the committee, which with Bob Cannon and others, a lot of others, produced the first set of policy on annual reviews. And I was also responsible for the formal abolition of what had been understood to be tenure, which was, again, not something that came naturally to me because I drafted a lot of the tenure statutes and negotiated on that from the other side. I mean, it happened, again, largely because, again, it was another change in the whole context of universities. The staff association I joined was the University of Adelaide Staff Association, and we were a constituent member of the Federation of Australian University Staff Associations. All true, all yes. But we were not a registered union. We didn't have to deal with the industrial commissions and the industrial courts. And the fundamental reason for that, initially, had been that the High Court in the 1920s, 1930s, had construed the industrial affairs power of the Commonwealth as not extending to workers and employees who were not involved in a rather restrictive definition of industry.
Right.
Right, which excluded education and a lot of office work generally. In the early 1980s, the High Court in the social welfare case changed its mind, and suddenly we became an industry. Now, Harry Medlin was president of FORSA at the time, and it was clear that we actually had to register as a union, because if we didn't, all the employees of universities were wide open to
poaching,
yes, by public sector and other unions. We'd already had some precursor of this, because in South Australia, the Public Service Association had already tried to take over those members of the professional staff who were members of the University of Adelaide Staff Association. They'd been held off in two ways. One, by the university, which did a wonderful piece of... the university solicitors did a wonderful piece of legal legerdemain and managed to get the full court of South Australia, the South Australian Supreme Court, to hold that the then power of the university council to have entire superintendence of the affairs of the university meant that it had entire and superintendence over everything, and that that excluded state industrial legislation. The unions had busily gone around to get that changed. But by then we'd negotiated industrial agreements I remember those rather vividly, because the first one was negotiated by me with Ted Shields in October 1974, in the year my father died in England, and I didn't go over.
Difficult.
So I didn't remember. So we'd held that off. But 1981, FORSA had to turn itself into something and register federally. But then it discovered itself in the rather nasty position that it could only actually maintain its registration if it did things in the commission. Otherwise, it would just lose its registration to the would-be poachers. And if it did things, it had to do things in accordance with the commission and the commission's... But it also meant that it was exposed to the federal government putting in arguments to the commission. So by the time I became executive member of staffing, we'd been in that position for some time. There was a national industrial enterprise bargain, we'd call it these days, which had already, to all intents and purposes, overridden our tenure statute, and was putting pressure, very strong pressure on us, not merely to have annual reviews of staff, but to make annual increments depend on annual reviews of staff. Now, one of the things that my past made it easier to do was to negotiate with the staff association on the abolition of tenure, and or tenure as it was then understood, and how and why it was to be replaced. And they were also involved in the PDR stuff, where, interestingly, one of the greatest enemies of the federal government was Bob Cannon, who ran the ACUE, was an integral member of that particular committee, and who thought that annual reviews were a good thing, but annual reviews should be used for developmental and constructive purposes, not for things that were...
Not for industrial purposes.
It was a ribbon committee because it had members of the university's personnel matters committee who were taking the other side. But, I mean, initially and for almost until now, we did manage to set up the whole PDR system in a way which did emphasise it's constructive. So, okay, you might say there was a tension there, but it wasn't just an industrial tension. There was a legitimate different view that came from elsewhere. So, and there were all sorts of things that I wanted to do, which the Staff Association was heavily involved in and quite keen on, even if they didn't necessarily ever happen. I mean, one of them, for instance, was just a matter of university titles, or academic titles. The Education Committee, before it was the Academic Board, did actually pass a resolution which had that all professors and associate professors should be called professors, all senior lecturers and lecturers should be called associate professors, and that all level A should be called assistant professors, and that professor, as in America and France, should be the generic title of the generic name for the profession, with other words used, but that never got put to council.
And was that something, I mean, what was the motive force behind that? Is it internationalism or...?
There were two motive forces. There was an element of nationalism, internationalism about it. The internationalism being that we have obviously inherited a UK system of titles, and increasingly people going on study leave in particular were going to the United States, and increasingly, even at the beginning of the 1990s, to China. Now, the United States didn't understand tutor lecturer, level A, level B, and people who were... readers and associate professors were really quite high in the system here, found that they were thought of as being quite junior when they went to the United States. So there was that level of internationalism. The other level of internationalism was, at the time, the emphasis was on something called the Pacific Rim. But it was also true that we were doing more with China, and China understood American titles better than it understood European ones. So it was, there was an internationalist line which was being pushed quite strongly. And the other thing, I suppose, was that it was felt, I think, that academic salaries were not going to move very well at the time, and that one way of reducing discontent about money is by the same process by which garbage collectors became public hygiene officers.
Yes, indeed. Very good. Well, you mentioned university titles, but you've been the beneficiary of a university title since your retirement, haven't you? You were awarded a Doctor of the University just a few years ago.
Yes, which was nice.
Yes.
I found it particularly nice because I was put up for it for my services to the university and to legal education in South Australia by a group of judges and former judges who had either, some of whom had worked with me either in the faculty or on the council, but also who also included members of the first classes I'd ever taught in the university. And that was really very nice of them. And it was also nice that at the actual award, the granting of the award was visibly appreciated by the cohort of the last students I'd ever taught.
Mm. Well, that's a very satisfying experience, I reckon.
And it's nice. I regard it as what you might describe as perhaps a way in which I resolved some of the potential tensions to which you referred when I was executive member of the staff. That I'm a doctor, that I've got a doctorate of the university, life membership of the NTEU, and life membership of the university club.
Excellent. Well, that's a series of roles.
In some ways, one can look back on a career like mine and say that it was actually academically a bit wasted. And I said I was the 10th member of to join the staff of the University of Adelaide. And of those 10, I was the only one who didn't end up a professor in a group of 8 university or its equivalent. But on the other hand, that was because I didn't devote enough attention to it, and I devoted attention to other things.
On the other hand, a glance at the internet, and one can see it, many tributes to you as a teacher by students over the years.
Really?
Indeed. Well, yes. So you've made your mark on generations.
The DUNIF was one thing. Yeah, I knew that. I did know that. Again, there was a 1990s, I suppose. The law school embarked on a kind of, would it be worth having a fundraising with the profession kind of activity. One of the early executive deans of the faculty of the professions hired people and they went out. The answer was a resounding no. but there were reports back that people did have affectionate memories of 3 or 4 or 5 members of the staff. Yes. I was one of them.
Very good, very good. Well, look, thank you, John. This has been a real pleasure talking to you, and these recollections, especially on the machinations of departmental government and the rise and fall of the Education Committee or its significance, will be something which will be of great interest for a very long time. So thank you for your this conversation, which I found both interesting and enjoyable.
I'm glad of that. There were a couple of things that I would have liked to have gone on to. Well, the first was that I didn't get on to sort of say that apart from Table 4, one of the things that I came to appreciate most was the enormous contributions that a group of scientists, Harold Rodder, Harry Medlin, Jerry Lawrence, made to the university overall. Harry was, of course, a great devotee of the union, as well as many other things on council. Jerry Lawrence chaired the library committee for years and years, but he was also the driving force behind getting some money and getting the council to back the establishment of the first university childcare centre.
Right.
And Harold Rodder had been, before I came here, and was a sort of major pillar of Forza and one of the people who, again, it's gone now, but it was a major feature of Australian universities for 30 or 40, 30 years at least after I came, that they had a common pay scale. And Harold Rodder had done an enormous amount of work in that. But the other thing that they'd done, which was really, really critical, was that in various ways, they were the people who produced the stimulus for the university's heritage committee, the art collection, the Harry and the Theatre. They believed that the university's intellectual role in the community meant that it should be a leader in its artistic activities and appreciation and should do things itself to stimulate that. The Elder Conservatorium was there to do it for music, but there was nobody there to do it for the other thing. I think the contributions of those three to the university in all sorts of ways is something that's really rather likely to be forgotten. Harold Rodder died before the D-Univ was instituted. Harry Medlin got one, and I still very resentful that Gerald Lawrence was not back for one.
And died earlier this year.
Or
was it the end of last year?
It may have
died
been.
Died recently.
And the other thing is the difference between becoming an academic in 1964 with a contract which essentially said 50% of the time will be for your own work, and being an academic now. And the other thing, which would never happen now, is that it wasn't clear what I was going to teach when I came here. In about, I did whatever was around, as it were, in September, October, November 1964. Around November, I was told that I'd be teaching trusts, which was fine, but that was only a third or half a course. And it wasn't until February 1965 that I was told that I was doing the whole of the Torts course on my own. Now, that was a full-year compulsory course. And, of course, while it was a common law subject, so an English background was fine, there was a lot of Australian stuff with which I had a kind of, at best, distant familiarity. We'd never do that to people now.
We'd
never say to a 23-year-old a month before the before a full year course starts, okay, that's what you're doing, and you're in full charge of everything.
Yes, job descriptions can be very long these days.
We just never do it. The two things about that is nobody pretends that 50% of the time is for your own work. Now, the agreement says, unless it's changed, 40% teaching, 40% research, 20% administration, and that's it. And nobody supervised you. I mean, you do it. You know, and it's a question of professional responsibility that you go off and you do it.
Yes.
You don't have, there weren't annual reviews or anything like it.
The list of publications, the number of grants received.
Well, that's another thing. Anybody who joins now will not be 23, but in any event, that they'll be told what we expect of you every year is X and X publications in Y kind of journals and all the rest of it. My equivalent instruction
was,
you know, it wouldn't hurt if you tried to publish one or two things. And, you know, the table for people with the intellectual curiosity, which was, I think, quite fundamental to the creativity of quite a lot of the university, were not people who published two articles a year in this or that kind of journal ever. It would have just, if they'd been made to, they might have.
Yes.
But it wasn't what they saw an intellectual life as being about.
So this is the change in the character of universities, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it is. It's a complete change in the character of universities.
Where they're externally directed enormously and managerialism.
It has a certain level of advantage and it loses an awful lot.
Indeed. Well, again, we'll have our second conclusion now. Thank you. That's very enjoyable, very interesting. This will be something which people will read and listen to for a very long time to come. So thank you. So this interview has been conducted on the 15th of May 2013 with Mr. John Keeler, or Dr. John Keeler, and Stephen Beaumont.
Well, thank you, Stephen.
I have to stop it. Press to stop.